Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one topic today, reparations for black Americans. There's no news hook, as we say in the trade. It's just an important issue I paid too little attention to on this show. My guest, William Darity, also known as Sandy, is an economist by training but holds several positions at Duke University, including professor of public policy, of African and African American studies, and of economics. He is the co-author, along with A. Kirsten Mullen, of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, published in 2020 by the University of North Carolina Press. The book, he told me, was a true collaboration, but the two authors have complementary specialties, both of which are present in the book. Mullen, in the words of her UNC Press bio, is a folklorist, museum consultant, and lecturer whose work focuses on race, art, history, and politics. The book is a thorough and highly readable historical overview of the injuries done to black Americans over the centuries, injuries that are ample justification for a reparations program, although that insight can run into some serious practical problems if you think about turning it into reality. Although reparations programs can take many forms, including affirmative action, as well as a broad social democratic agenda that would disproportionately benefit black Americans because of a poverty rate that's 2.5 times that of whites, Darity and Mullen advocate a program of large cash payments whose aim would be to eliminate the enormous wealth gap between black and white Americans. According to the Federal Reserve, the average black household has a net worth, meaning what they own less what they owe, that's less than a quarter the average white household's. These averages are means, total net worth divided by the number of households. Simple averages, in other words. Since wealth is very unequally distributed, money at the high end pulls those averages way up. A more representative number would be median net worth, the wealth of the household in the middle of the distribution, meaning half the households are richer and half are poorer. In 2019, the racial gap at the median was even larger than at the mean. The median black household has a net worth of just $9,000. 6% as much as the median white household's $160,000. But regardless of how you measure it, the gap is enormous. And though the gap has wobbled some over the decades, it's little different from where it was 30 years ago. So much for a post-racial society. Darity and others focus on the wealth gap because it's an excellent single measure of the effects of generations of discrimination and chronic poverty or advantage. Black households have far fewer resources to pass along to their children, a gap that is not only a function of past racial disparities, but one that helps perpetuate them. People with inheritances, even relatively modest ones, find it easier to buy a house, send the kids to college, start a business, or survive a spell of unemployment. Darity and Mullen aim to close that gap with direct cash payments. I said earlier there was no news hook that inspired my choice of guest, but that's not exactly true. Matt Brunig, who's written a lot of good material in economics and politics, made the argument recently that the black-white wealth gap is almost entirely a function of disparities at the high end of the distribution. Take those away and the overall gap largely disappears. I really don't get how he came to this conclusion, given the enormous 18-to-1 gap at the median, but it's something that people opposed to the idea of reparations like Adolf Reed have embraced. Musing on these figures made me think of Sandy Darity, who was on this show back in 2015, also to discuss the racial wealth gap. And that took me to the topic of reparations and the book he wrote with A. Kirsten Mullen. I must say I find it very hard to imagine a world in which a reparations program can be enacted in a country that hates to acknowledge the dark sides of its past and finds itself unable to enact a minimally civilized welfare state. But it's still something to think about, a horizon to steal Jody Dean's concept. Sandy Darity. Before we get going, and I'll return to this issue later, but I want to get something out of the way at the start. I'm sure a lot of people hear about reparations, even people of fairly goodwill, who will say, you know, it was a long time ago, that time is way past, everyone's dead, time to move on. I'm sure you hear that very often. What is your reaction?
So first of all, I'm not sure what they're claiming is a long time ago. I presume it might be slavery, but certainly the wave of atrocities that have been inflicted on black Americans did not end with slavery. And so as a consequence, we have another dimension of the historical record that's coming into play in the present moment. And we could also make the argument that the long-term effects of slavery itself are still present. But one of the other points we make in the book is actually, from the standpoint of generations, slavery itself was not that long ago. And we actually tell the story of a woman who was the first black faculty member at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Hortense McClinton, whose father was born in early 1865 into slavery. She is now 102 years of age, but she is one generation removed from slavery. Her case is exceptional, but there are many, many examples of individuals who are no more than 3 to 4 generations removed from slavery itself. It actually wasn't that long ago, if we think about family histories, but also its repercussions are still present. And then in our book, we argue that the case for reparations is not predicated exclusively on slavery, but that we have to take into account nearly a century of legal segregation in the United States, what we somewhat politely refer to as the Jim Crow period, but it was American apartheid. And we also have to take into account ongoing atrocities, including police executions of unarmed blacks. We have to take into account ongoing discrimination in housing, credit, and employment. We need to take into account, and this is perhaps most central to our book, the staggering gap in wealth between blacks and whites that's a product of these historical policies that have taken place in the United States. And that gap now amounts to approximately $840,000 per black and white household.
All right, I want to return to all these issues in more detail in a bit, but let's talk first about the history of the idea of reparations. It's really quite an old one, right? It goes way back.
One could argue that to some degree it actually goes back to the period in which the Republic was founded, if not earlier. There were some overtures that were made by Thomas Paine about the provision of land to individuals who had been enslaved, given his expectation that slavery might come to an end with the formation of the United States. Of course, that's not what happened, but Paine made some overtures to that effect. There was a court case brought by a woman named Belinda in Massachusetts who had been enslaved, asking for back pay for the years of bondage. And she actually won her case, although I'm not certain that the amount that she was awarded was commensurate with what she was truly owed. In the latter part of the 19th century, there was a movement that was led by a woman named Callie House to get the formerly enslaved pensions from the United States government comparable to the pensions that were paid to military veterans. And then, of course, before that was the critical point in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, where a promise was made to the formerly enslaved of 40-acre land grants. And that was a promise that was not kept. It would have provided a foundation for building wealth on the part of the formerly enslaved, a foundation that they were denied, while at the same time the federal government was giving 1.5 million white families 160-acre land grants in the Western territories under the Homestead Act. And then in the 20th century, the Garvey movement included a dimension that was focused on reparations for black Americans whose ancestors had been enslaved in the United States. That was followed by efforts on the part of Queen Mother Audley Moore to solicit the support of the United Nations for reparations for black Americans. The United Nations ultimately has had a working group that around 2015 endorsed reparations for black Americans. But of course, the United Nations doesn't have the capacity to enforce any kind of action by a particular government. After Queen Audley Moore's efforts, there have been a number of organizations that have attempted to continue to carry the torch for reparations. Things have actually been fairly quiet on the national front for a long, long time. There was a burst of activity around reparations that took place circa the year 2000, when David Horowitz placed a set of advertisements against reparations in a number of college newspapers. That seemed to spark or trigger a substantial amount of conversations and activism on college campuses. But that whole momentum was shut down in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And there wasn't any significant attention drawn to reparations again until Ta-Nehisi Coates published this article in The Atlantic called The Case for Reparations. And even after that, attention died down until the 2019 year of the election cycle, where for the first time, to my knowledge, a significant number of credible candidates for the presidency actually uttered the term reparations.
Our first black president swatted the idea down when asked about it, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. Barack Obama was opposed to reparations. That's one of the reasons that I personally have felt a great deal of dissatisfaction with his presidency.
One could make a long list.
Yes, we could. especially if we started exploring foreign policy also.
Yeah.
Anyway, in 2019, Marianne Williamson endorsed reparations. Julian Castro endorsed reparations for black Americans. Tom Steyer endorsed reparations. None of them were very specific about what that would constitute. Marianne Williamson went the furthest in saying that she would try to establish a fund of $500 billion for the purposes of reparations. My reaction to that was that that was a paltry sum and far, far below any reasonable estimate of what the magnitude of the bill should be. But it was significant that she actually said she was in favor of reparations. Since 2019, particularly with the effects of 2020, the combination of COVID-19, the wave or surge in political action that took place in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, reparations has continued to be something that has been in the national eye. And in the national eye in a way that I don't think it has been present since the Reconstruction era.
You mentioned a court case in Massachusetts, and you know, people generally think of slavery as mostly a Southern thing, which I guess it was, but there were slaves across the country, much in the North, but also a great lot of Northern fortunes, like Lehman Morgan Tiffany associated with slavery, the Ivy League drenched in it, even Brooks Brothers, I'm wearing one of their shirts right now, as a matter of fact, they were involved in with slavery. So yeah, this is really deeply, deeply influential on the early capital formation of the United States.
Yeah, it's foundational to the early capital formation of the United States. You know, people could argue that it didn't have to happen that way, but it is the way it happened.
Now, some people who downplay the effects of slavery will point to the fact that in the early colonial days, there were white indentured servants who were treated rather similarly to black indentured servants. But then things changed sometime in the late 17th century, particularly in Virginia. How did slavery become racialized in the way that we came to know it?
Well, I think the narrative that we report in the book that is drawn from work by historians is that the turning point was Nathaniel Bacon's rebellion in Virginia, where he had organized essentially a multiracial group that resisted the practices of the colonial government in Virginia. And in the aftermath of the suppression of that uprising, they proceeded to create a divide and rule policy with respect to blacks and whites in Virginia. It's at that point that you get the consolidation of the condition of lifetime servitude that was associated with blacks, system of slavery, in contrast with a period of fixed servitude that was associated with the indentures. And not only that, at the point at which indentureship was over, the colony of Virginia at that point introduced what was known as a headright system, which was the provision of substantial land grants to individuals who managed to survive the period of indentureship.
There was a high mortality rate, right?
There was a high mortality rate. Yes. So whether or not you made it through the period of indentureship was a matter of risk, absolutely. But for those who did, they frequently received substantial land grants and became slave owners themselves. And one of the stories that we relate is I think, Reba McEntire's fourth great-grandfather, who was brought to colonial Virginia as an indenture at less than 10 years of age. He did manage to survive the period of indentureship and was given a substantial headright claim. by the next generation, his family had become significant slave owners.
I'm speaking with William Barity, co-author along with A. Kirsten Mullen of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, published in 2020 by the University of North Carolina Press. You recount a number of what we call, I guess, missed opportunities to end slavery. Somehow slavery was won out. But yeah, could you recount some of those opportunities that popped up were then beaten down?
One of the points at which slavery could have been terminated was at the very beginning of the Republic. I mean, it was possible that the United States could have been formed without being a slave republic. I'm not sure what the configuration of states would have been. I suspect that not all of the colonies would have joined such an effort. And it also raises the question as to whether or not the Revolutionary War would have ended with a success that resulted in the formation of the United States. But it was certainly something that was debated in the Continental Congresses, and it was always something that was possible, was to start this new country on a footing where there would be no slavery. So that was one of the central opportunities for change. Additional opportunities took place during the course of the period between 1776 and 1865, where there were a number of proposals for what we might refer to as compensated emancipation. That is, pay the slaveholders to emancipate their human chattel.
And not compensate the slaves,
compensate the owners. At that point, the question of compensation for the slaves was treated as a separate issue. It was not necessarily mutually exclusive, but there was much more attention drawn to the idea of paying the slaveholders for emancipation. There's kind of two ways of thinking about that, at least. One is, well, that's kind of perverse to pay the slaveholders for their enslaved people. But a more positive take on it is, had that actually occurred, we would not have had the Civil War. Not having had the Civil War, the formation of the Confederacy and the like, would have led to a very different future for the United States from the one that it encountered. And it certainly would have meant that you would not necessarily have lost the lives of some 700,000 people during the course of the Bloody War.
And we can skip forward a bit to the Civil War itself, or at the end of the Civil War. General Sherman had a proposal to give vast plots of lands to the freed slaves. What was his proposal and what happened to it?
To be precise, it wasn't just General Sherman's proposal. It was actually a plan that was crafted at the cabinet level of the federal government. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton actually was with General Sherman when he had a conversation with 20 leaders of the black community in Savannah, Georgia, that led to the field order that he issued that provided the 40-acre land grants. This was Special Field Orders number 15. It was issued about 4 days after Sherman and Stanton met with the 20 black leaders that I've mentioned. They asked these individuals what they wanted in the aftermath of the war, since it was apparent that the war was about to come to an end with a Union victory. The spokesperson for the group, Reverend Garrison Frazier, said, essentially, we would like land. We would like to have our young men serve in the Union military, and we would like our older men, women, and children to till the fields, and otherwise we'd like to be left alone. And so they were even asked, if they had a preference for living among other blacks or living in what we might now refer to as integrated communities. And with the exception of one person in the group, they all said that they preferred to live as a community of black people separate from white Americans because of the hostility that the Southerners, the white Southerners, had displayed toward them, both during the period of slavery, during the war, and a hostility that they anticipated would continue in the aftermath of the war. So Sherman issues Special Field Orders number 15. It designates a territory that stretches from the Sea Islands of South Carolina to northern Florida, bordered by the St. John's River, approximately 5.3 million acres of land that was allocated to be settled specifically by the formerly enslaved. And we could view this as a down payment on a larger allocation that would have provided the 40-acre land grants for the 4 million formerly enslaved persons. But that 5.3 million acres was never distributed to the formerly enslaved. The maximum that was ever distributed was about 400,000 acres to 40,000 of the formerly enslaved. That allocation, which was a small part of the total that was specified in Special Field Orders number 15, was taken back and restored to the former slaveholders by President Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor after Lincoln was murdered.
Now, Johnson did a lot of mischief in the years after the Civil War, right?
Johnson was one of the central actors in undercutting the spirit and intent of Reconstruction.
He didn't always seem that way, right? He talked a good talk for a while, but then when actually he took power, he restored the status of the Confederacy.
Absolutely. He proved to be one of the central actors to promote the restoration of the power of the former Confederates. He refused to engage in a process of lustration, which would have excluded them from participation in electoral politics. He pardoned them all, virtually all of them, en masse, and he denied significant support for voting rights for the formerly enslaved, and he destroyed the 40-acre land grant plan.
Now, you think that a national government that had just defeated forces that had taken up arms against, by any definition, traitorous, treasonous, you would think that there would be a lot of hangings and expropriations. What were the politics that made that not happen?
It was a question of who were the individuals who managed to have control over the executive branch of the government, starting with Andrew Johnson. There was a tremendous sentiment in the American Congress that was heavily influenced by the folks who were referred to as the Radical Republicans for an intense and fierce plan of Reconstruction to establish the conditions of full citizenship for the folks who had just been emancipated from slavery. And their efforts were consistently circumvented by the executive branch. And as I said, that process of circumvention begins with Andrew Johnson.
And the North, a lot of people in the North just didn't want to be bothered. They were sick of the South, and sick of the Civil War, and just didn't want to be bothered. Was that the attitude?
Well, I think they didn't want to be bothered with black people. And so essentially there was a strong effort made to reconcile the white North and the white South, but that process of reconciliation required trampling on the rights and opportunities of the folks who had been newly emancipated.
The South began very quickly to try to restore some version of the antebellum order, antebellum social order. In some ways, the labor conditions for black people in the South in the years after the war were even worse than slavery days. But there was also this concept, dismemory, organized systematic efforts to distort the history, began right after the end of the Civil War. And I didn't know this, but the term the lost cause first popped up in 1866. What was going on there? Who was behind this, and how extensive was it?
My co-author, Kirsten Mullen, is the person who introduced the phrase dismemory into our conversation in our book. But the idea here is that there's a systematic or conscious effort to distort the historical record and to make heroes out of traitors, to make the story of particular atrocities look like they were benevolent actions. In the aftermath of the Civil War, you get these folks who are crafting romantic visions of the period of slavery and arguing that, well, it was a school for civilization for these savages who had been imported from Africa. Well, they were forcibly imported, and they came from cultures that had their own rich traditions. But that's something that was excised from the narratives that were told by the proponents of the lost cause. And they were especially effective because they were able to mobilize in such a way that they could influence what was happening in terms of curriculum and instruction in schools. And they were active in selecting textbooks for schools. If they weren't satisfied with the available textbooks, they didn't think that those available textbooks told the story of the Confederacy as a heroic project. Women who were in the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Daughters of the American Revolution would write their own textbooks that would then be placed into schools. And so they promoted this activity that we refer to as dismemory for the purposes of winning an ideological battle, essentially winning the hearts and minds of the American people to think that what happened during the Civil War was just an upset between two sets of brothers that could be healed and should be healed despite the consequences for the folks who had been enslaved.
Healed on terms largely set, it seems, by the slave owners and their descendants.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the textbooks. I mean, it sounds really familiar. I mean, we're going through this today.
Yes. You know, there's a number of instances where school curricula have been objects of contestation, both for positive and negative reasons. And this would be an instance where the contestation was for largely negative reasons. There's an indirect relationship to questions of race, but the fight over whether or not human evolution should be taught in schools is another example, which resulted in the Scopes trial in 1925. One of the ironies is, of course, Scopes himself was using the theory of evolution to promote notions of black inferiority as well as to support eugenics. So Scopes himself was not particularly an unvarnished heroic figure, but the question of whether or not the most recent developments in science at that point should be taught to students in schools was a point of conflict. So it's another example. And then today, we have this outcry over so-called critical race theory, which in many respects resembles the efforts of the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Daughters of the American Revolution to control the narrative of American history in such a way that slavery is whitewashed and the Confederacy emerges as a failed but heroic project.
And then, of course, there are the statues, which a lot of them were put up in the 20s, right? What were the statues meant to do? Why did they arise in the 20s and, you know, not earlier?
So, actually, we really see a significant wave of memorialization of figures in the Confederacy that takes place essentially around the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. It's that point at which there were still a significant number of living veterans who would meet and make displays of unity between the former Union veterans and the former Confederate veterans. And it's at that point where, in some sense, an effort is made to consolidate the view that there was bravery and integrity on both sides. And so you begin to have the erection of these monuments to the Confederacy. But I think it's largely has to do with the timing, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war.
That was the first part of my interview with William Darity, a professor of public policy, African-American studies and economics at Duke, and co-author, along with A. Kirsten Mullen, of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, which came out in 2020 from the University of North Carolina Press. My name is Doug Henry, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
from a scientific point of view, it is now very likely that there will be again another ice age quite soon in the world, that we shall have the north part of the world all frozen like it used to be, and we're beginning to have natural disasters. From a scientist's study, it seems likely that we shall soon begin to have these great changes in the Earth's climate, so people will not be able to live.
How some of Water Music One, a song from Robert Fripp's 1977 album Exposure. And now the second part of my interview with William Sandy Darity, co-author, along with A. Kristen Mullen, of From Here to Equality, published a couple of years ago by the University of North Carolina Press. Moving closer to the present, we touched on this earlier when we said, you know, it was not a long time ago. It continued for much of American history. But you, of course, write about many various outrages perpetrated on black Americans by white Americans. Highways, the interstate highway system flattening neighborhoods, medical experimentation, dumping of environmental toxins. This is a story that goes on for decades, even into the present. This idea that these injuries are things in the misty past, and we've all moved on from that, is just completely inaccurate.
Yes, and I think another set of atrocities that must be mentioned are the wave of 100 or so massacres that took place from the end of the Civil War into the 1940s. Perhaps the most notorious is the Tulsa massacre of 1921, and I think it has notoriety because a lot of attention was given to it in 2021, which was the 100th year since the massacre actually took place. But there were actually upwards of 100 of these. And, you know, in North Carolina, the one that is of greatest significance is the massacre that took place in Wilmington in 1898.
Well, and also really, even in the years just after the war, whenever black people tried to assert any kind of civil rights, there would be, you know, yeah, smaller scale massacres, but there were massacres.
Yeah, and there were literal coup d'etats in locations like Coushatta, Louisiana, Vicksburg, Mississippi, Colfax, Louisiana. People frequently say that what took place in Wilmington in 1898 was the only known American municipal coup d'etat, but that's not true. In the aftermath of the Civil War, when black people were engaged in the process of governing collaboratively with whites who were receptive to co-governance, the response of the former Confederates was to literally overthrow those municipal governments, not only driving people out of town, but often killing them. That phase in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War is particularly dramatic. But in subsequent massacres, not only was there a political motivation, but there was frequently a motivation that was associated with the taking of black property, the taking of black property or the destruction of black property. And this is something that was particularly noteworthy in instances like the massacre that took place in Ocoee, Florida. You know, in the year 1919 alone, there were upwards of 35 of these massacres that took place all across the country, ranging from Bisbee, Arizona, to Chicago, Illinois, to Wilmington, Delaware, to Elaine, Arkansas, and so on. And in all of these cases, black lives were taken and black property was seized or appropriated in some way.
Okay, now let's move on specifically to the question of reparations. Let me just rehearse a few of objections that people have when they hear the word. We dealt with and dismissed successfully the so long ago argument. But it'll just annoy white people and make things worse. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that the way in which we propose to have reparations instituted is to have Congress enact a law. And for congressional action to take place, there would need to be a significant amount of political support from all Americans. And so to the extent that there would be folks who would be upset by this, they would be a numerical minority. Now, they might be a very dangerous numerical minority, and their behavior would have to be anticipated and dealt with. It would be impossible to have reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery legislated in the United States without a strong political majority being in favor of that taking place. And we have always advocated that that's the way in which it should happen.
And not through the courts.
Not through the courts. The courts have not been receptive to reparations. They've either said that statute of limitations has been exhausted, although I'm not sure, you know, what that means in this context. They have also said that sovereign immunity applies, and so that the federal government can't really be sued for this. All of this suggests that it requires congressional action. And a final point about the judiciary is if the judiciary's decided a suit in favor of the claimants for reparations, how would they enforce it?
Another objection people make, in my case, my ancestors from Italy and Ireland, it's not my responsibility. Why should I pay?
Well, your ancestors may have come after slavery ended, but then the question remains, did they arrive during the course of the period of legal segregation? Did they benefit from the 160-acre land grants under the Homestead Act, land grants that were denied to Black Americans? Did any of your ancestors benefit from the provisions of the GI Bill that gave people an opportunity to purchase homes or to start businesses? The GI Bill, which was discriminatorily applied in such a way that the number of Black veterans who had access to the benefits was extremely low. Do your ancestors benefit from the fact that we live in a society where there are structured advantages for individuals who are white and not for Black? So, yes, I mean, folks might have arrived after slavery, but the period of slavery is hardly the whole story.
In my case, the answers would be yes in most cases. A lot of other groups, notably the indigenous population, have suffered grievous ills. They deserve some recompense, too. Why should we single out Black people?
Well, it's interesting that that question wasn't asked when reparations were provided as appropriately for Japanese Americans who have been subjected to mass incarceration during World War II. It seems the question of, you know, the deservedness of other groups is only raised when people are talking about reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. There's no doubt that there's probably any number of communities, including Native Americans, who have legitimate claims on the federal government. And we encourage them to make those claims. So no doubt there are others with legitimate claims, and by all means, bring them forward. But let's not do that in such a way that we undercut the longstanding debt that is owed to Black Americans.
And then another objection, a lot of poor white people don't have so great a time of it either, and if anything, it's deteriorating. What about them?
I think if people are truly concerned about the question of class inequality in the United States, that requires a particular set of policies, but they're separate policies from a reparations plan, which is intended to address a longstanding debt or justice claim for a particular community in this country. You know, personally, I'm a strong advocate of what several of us have called an economic bill of rights for the 21st century, which would be a set of proposals that would create a foundation for economic security for all Americans. But I don't see that as an alternative to or a substitute for reparations, which has a very different objective, which is elimination of the racial wealth gap.
I'm speaking with William Darity, co-author along with A. Kirsten Mullen of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, published in 2020 by the University of North Carolina Press. Yeah, you do focus on the wealth gap. First of all, why is that? Let me just start with that. Why do you emphasize the wealth gap? So
one reason is because you could think about trying to establish a cost claim for reparations that would be based upon itemization of each of the atrocities that have been inflicted on Black Americans, and then trying to provide a dollar value for each atrocity, and then adding up the whole sum. We think that that's unrealistic, impractical. And so instead, we've tried to identify a summary statistic that could capture the cumulative intergenerational effects of American racism on Black Americans whose ancestors were enslaved here. And the summary statistic that we think is the most effective is wealth, because it essentially captures the cross-generational effects of the advantages that have been built into American policy for white wealth accumulation and the disadvantages for Black wealth accumulation. So the wealth gap becomes the instrument that we have been best able to identify that can capture in a comprehensive way the effects of American racism on the economic status and well-being of Black Americans.
And what do you make of the argument that Matt Brunig has been making, and one embraced by Adolf Reed, that the Black-white wealth inequality gap is a function almost entirely of things at the high end, that if you take the high end away, the top 10% or so, then it largely disappears? What do you think of that?
Well, I think in terms of monetary value, the dollar value of the gap, it is virtually all at the upper end. But that's in terms of the absolute differential. The relative differentials are substantial all along the income distribution. So, for example, whites who are in the lowest quintile of the income distribution, the poorest whites, the bottom 20% of the income distribution, actually have a higher median wealth than all Black Americans combined. And within their quintile, their median wealth or median net worth is virtually 10 times the median net worth of Blacks who are also in that lowest income quintile. I could go further and point out that as you move along the income distribution, the dollar value gets wider. The relative gap actually gets somewhat smaller, although at the very upper end of the distribution, where we're talking about the top 1%, of course, it becomes explosively wide because of the presence of a vast number of a significant number of white male billionaires. There aren't that many white female billionaires, but there are a couple. But that's where you get an explosive difference in the absolute dollar value. However, it's not just the presence of these billionaires that is at stake in terms of explaining the wealth gap, nor is it exclusively the top 10% of the distribution for each group. 25% of white American households have a net worth in excess of $1 million, and that is true for only 4% of Black American households. The final key point that I'd like to make that is actually consistent with what Matt Brunig says, but is actually a justification for focusing on the mean or the average gap, is the fact that 97% of the wealth that is held by white households is held by white households that have a net worth above the median for white households, 97%. So if you were to focus exclusively on the median, which is one of the implications of Matt Brunig's position, then you would be ignoring 97% of the wealth that is being held by white Americans from consideration in terms of thinking about the gap.
But even at the median, the gap is not insignificant.
No, the gap is not insignificant at the median. But I guess the Brunig argument is once you get to the median, there's not much of a difference. But I think that there is actually a substantial difference below the median. And so, yeah, so the measured difference at the median is actually not trivial. But if you were thinking about trying to close the gap, it's a far easier or simpler task if your focus is on the median rather than the mean.
Now, putting a price tag on this is no easy matter. You present estimates that I think range from about $3 billion to $100 trillion. That should be a matter of the checks written to cover reparations. How do you put an estimate on it, and where do you come out on this question?
In terms of the kind of conclusion that we draw in From Here to Equality, our book, we say that it's the racial wealth gap at the mean that should dictate what the magnitude must be at the minimum amount of a reparations bill. And now today we estimate that that figure is about $14 trillion, that that's the amount that would be required to bring the average level of wealth for Black Americans up to the average level of wealth that's held by white Americans.
That's a lot of money. You'd have a hard time winning a majority support for that, it seems to me.
Well, I don't know. Clearly, people might view that as a daunting sum. But I've seen some estimates, and there are some estimates that run as high as the quadrillions.
Oh, my God. So this is a steal, right?
No, this is, folks are getting off easy. But no, more seriously, I think that there has been a change in attitude towards the question of monetary payments for reparations to Black Americans among white Americans. And it's been a fairly dramatic change. We're not at a position in which there's a majority. I'm not sure if the change is something that's sustainable, but it's definitely a very different set of circumstances from the conditions that existed at the beginning of the 21st century. In the year 2000, when Michael Dawson and Ravana Popoff did a survey of American attitudes towards reparations, they found that only 4% of white Americans endorsed monetary payments for reparations for Black Americans. By the year 2018, that percentage had risen to 16%. And today, the proportion of white Americans that say that they would favor monetary payments as reparations for Black Americans is about 30%. So the trajectory is one that appears to be positive. I'm convinced that there will always be about 30% of white Americans who are opposed to any kind of policy that appears to benefit Black Americans. But if we can go from 30% to closer to 60%, then we're in the ballpark of really having a serious opportunity to enact a reparations plan.
How do you figure out who qualifies? I imagine that if you started handing out free money, that would greatly increase the portion of the population that self-identifies as Black by enormous numbers. So how do you figure out?
That's a variant of a moral hazard problem.
Yeah. So how do you figure out who qualifies?
We propose two criteria in From Here to Equality. They're criteria that I think originally were presented in the paper that I did with Dania Frank that was published around 2003 in the American Economic Association's proceedings. But the two criteria are the following. The first is an individual would have to demonstrate that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And second, for at least 12 years prior to the enactment of a reparations plan or the enactment of a study commission for reparations, they would have to show that they self-identified on an official document as Black, Negro, African American, or Afro-American. So the first is a lineage standard, the second is an identity standard, and both conditions would need to be met for eligibility for receipt of reparations.
This would be a really ambitious genealogical project, though. It doesn't seem like a simple affair.
Well, and in fact, in our book, we talk about the importance of the federal government establishing an agency with trained genealogists to assist people in making their claim. But there has been a remarkable improvement and an expansion of genealogical research on Black families. So we clearly think that it's feasible to do this, but we would like to see the government provide people with cost-free support for establishing their claims.
Several times you mentioned the precedent of German reparations for the Holocaust. Norman Finkelstein argued that a lot of that money was largely claimed by lawyers in the Israeli government, leaving not very much for the victims of the Holocaust. There is a problem of middlemen, and I think some people have brought up the risk of black elites somehow getting at most of the money and leaving the poor largely untouched. How do you deal with that sort of problem?
We feel strongly that reparations should be dispersed as direct payments to each individual eligible recipient. We do not think that there should be some third party or intermediary organization that plays the role of managing the funds. And so here we depart very strongly from organizations like the National African American Reparations Commission, known as NARC.
That's not a very fortunate acronym, is it?
Well, the other one is the National Coalition on Reparations for Black Americans, and it's known as NCOBRA. So NARC and NCOBRA have the view that there should be some kind of management of the funds that takes place through either what they call a National Reparations Authority or by local organizations that have been established to promote reparations. And we think that either one of these tactics is really, really dangerous and potentially can subvert the effectiveness of a reparations program. So we think the payments should be made directly to individuals. And if somebody is underage, then the funds should be held in a trust account until they reach the age of majority.
Okay, finally, towards the end of the book, you mention whites who are descended from slave owners. What, if anything, can they contribute to the effort?
The most important thing they could contribute to the effort is to be passionate and well-informed proponents of a comprehensive national reparations plan.
That's the concluding part of my interview with William Darity, a professor of public policy, African American studies and economics at Duke, and co-author, along with A. Kirsten Mullen, of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, published in 2020 by the University of North Carolina Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from Robert Fripp's album Exposure, this Breathless. Till next week, bye.